Good morning, I'm Allison Ruttenberg, registration number 72497, and I am pro bono counsel for Mr. Jose Barco. And the first issue I would like to address today is the issue of whether Mr. Brown's testimony regarding what was contained in the bullet report that was prepared by Stephanie McMillan is testimonial hearsay, and if so, violated Mr. Barco's Sixth Amendment right to confrontation, and also whether that was harmless error. So, first of all, we concede that the bullet report itself was not introduced into evidence. However, we still contend that testimonial hearsay was introduced into evidence when, on the 1st of October 2009, page 105, lines 20 through 23, Mr. Brown testified that all of the bullets, those are the bullets that were test fired from Mr. Barco's gun, as well as the bullets collected from the crime scene, had the same widths of the lands and grooves, same twist in the lands and grooves. Now, that was an out-of-court statement made by Stephanie McMillan, introduced for the truth of the matter, because Mr. Brown did not conduct those measurements himself. The only way he knew that that was true was because he was reading off the bullet report prepared by Stephanie McMillan. He conceded, even though he was her supervisor and she was a trainee, that he did not independently perform those measurements, and he was not there when she performed those measurements.
Excuse me. Continue with your sentence. Finish your sentence. I'm sorry.
Okay. He peer-reviewed her, which means he looked at her report after she finished it to be sure that she didn't quote-unquote missed something. In other words, that she forgot to take one of the measurements, forgot one of the bullets. But he did not independently go back and do those measurements. So the only reason he would know what those measurements were is if he read off of that report.
Ms. Redenberg, didn't he ultimately concede, however, that it was inconclusive whether or not those bullets, the bullets at the scene, came from the defendant's gun?
Well, that concession contradicts what I just read you straight out of the record, that they all had the same characteristics, the same widths in the lands and grooves, same twists in the land and grooves, making it look like that those bullets all had the same tool markings as if they were fired from the same gun.
So he was impeached?
Well, that was on direct. I mean, he contradicted himself on direct then.
I guess I don't understand that, Ms. Redenberg. As Judge Graham said, the ultimate conclusion was, I cannot say these bullets came from this gun. And the best he did was, these bullets were consistent as coming from this gun. And then he also said, and that was consistent with millions, literally millions of other guns. That was his testimony. So I think where Judge Graham is going is the same concern I have. What difference does it make? He used them, and maybe I'm not understanding what he used the measurements for, but I think his purpose was to try to tie the bullets to the gun, and he said he couldn't do that.
Right, but that was after he said that all these bullets looked the same. So that, I mean, that's a problem, and I realize that that issue goes to the harmless error, but a jury hearing that, you know, remember, there is no other testimony directly tying Mr. Barco to the crime scene, except for the tainted tainted photo lineup, which I'll address in a minute. All of the witnesses were very, very contradictory as to which of the two gentlemen was the shooter. And this is one piece of physical evidence that you can latch onto. It's like, oh, the bullets look the same from his gun and from the crime scene. And that is why we are arguing that there was no harmless error as a matter of beyond a reasonable doubt, because a jury hearing what I just read is going to be focusing on, yes, but the bullets look the same.
Can the jurors separate that out from the conclusion the expert gave, which was, I can't say these bullets came from this gun, or that this is consistent with millions, could have come from millions of other guns? He used the word millions.
Right.
So I guess I'm not understanding your argument. You seem to be wanting us to focus that the jury would have said, okay, yeah, the bullets are about the same, and that made a difference notwithstanding the rest of the testimony, and I'm not sure we can separate out the testimony.
Well, I mean, and the testimony is what the testimony is, and this came out on direct and was very forceful and was very, you know, strong, and only later when he started to be nibbled away at, then he made that concession. But after he'd already established these bullets looked the same, and a jury who's struggling with what happened here, we need something to tell us whether it was Mr. Morales or Mr. Barco who filed the gun are going to be listening to say, wait a minute, you know, these bullets are the same. They came from Mr. Barco's gun.
Redenberg, on that same point, experts frequently rely upon hearsay. That's permissible. And to the extent that you're concerned about confrontation, doesn't the fact that this particular expert ultimately concedes the point give you all the confrontation that you needed of this particular witness?
No, because he didn't concede the point that all of the marks measured exactly the same. I mean, that is the critical piece of testimony here from page 105, lines 20 through 23. I mean, he didn't equivocate at all. He said they have the same widths of the lands and grooves. So those measurements themselves and Stephanie McMillan's report regarding those measurements, and they are the same, they are exact. That is the testimonial hearsay. Now, I think the government also tried to make some other points. For instance, Mr. Brown signed off on the report, but that's not enough to overcome the confrontation clause, because otherwise you would have a laboratory where you have a bunch of lab technicians doing these types of tests and writing reports, and then you'd have just one person in the lab who'd be like the designated testifier who would go sign off on all the reports and get around the confrontation clause issue. So that, to me, that's a red herring and does not comply with either Bullcoming or Melendez-Diaz. Then the government is also arguing that, well, this is really Mr. Barco's fault because he opposed the continuance so that Ms. McMillan could testify. And if he hadn't opposed the continuance, then she would have been present to testify. And I pointed out in my reply brief that he opposed the continuance because if he agreed to the continuance, then he'd be giving up his right to a speedy trial, and he cannot be forced to choose between two important constitutional rights, and then the government complain that they don't like his choice. And also, it's the DA's responsibility to ensure that the speedy trial statute is complied with, not the defendant's. And here, the DA had Ms. McMillan under subpoena for months before this training was even scheduled. Therefore, he would have had to release her from the subpoena so she could even go attend the training. So it's really the DA's fault that he was in that predicament. All he had to do was not allow Ms. McMillan to be released from her subpoena, and he never made any showing that this training was so important and so necessary that she had to go and attend it that week and it couldn't be rescheduled. Now, I'd like to briefly address the third issue in my brief. I'm going to rest on my arguments on the second issue. The third issue is regarding Mr. Tassia's identification of Mr. Barco from the photo lineup. And in the Bernal case, the Colorado Supreme Court set a two-part test for whether a photo lineup is impermissibly tainted or impermissibly suggestive. And first, the court must determine whether the photo array was impermissibly suggestive, and which the defendant has the burden. And then the burden shifts to the people to show that notwithstanding the improper suggestiveness of the photo array, the identification was nevertheless reliable under the totality of the circumstances. Here, Mr. Tassia remembers that he thought that Mr. Barco was in the military. Previously, he had picked out Mr. Morales, the co-defendant, out of the lineup. And remember, all of the witnesses are contradicting each other as to who they thought the shooter was. But pretty much all of the witnesses agree that it was the shorter of the two men who was the shooter. And Mr. Barco is the taller of the two men. And there were two witnesses who picked him out of the lineup. The first was Ms. Reyes.
What was the difference in height?
An inch. Ms. Reyes was the girlfriend of Mr. Morales, so, you know, she's going to pick Mr. Barco out of the lineup, and she knows both of them. Mr. Tassia doesn't know either of them, and first he identifies Mr. Morales as the shooter. Then he remembers, oh yeah, I thought I heard that Mr. Barco was in the military. And then he's shown a second photo lineup where the only person in the photo lineup wearing a military uniform is Mr. Barco.
What do you see from that?
You can clearly see that the...
I looked at it.
With the BDU, anybody in Colorado Springs, which is the military community, is going to recognize that that desert BDU pattern, and you immediately think military.
So, Redenburg, wouldn't anyone in Colorado Springs also take a look at the individual with the blue shirt and recognize it as an Air Force uniform?
There's an issue here regarding the fact that he was in the Army, and I think that there was other information regarding the Army and that he was a recent veteran of the war. You know,
was there anything tying Tassia said Army? I don't recall seeing that. He said he could have been in the military. He's fairly vague, right?
Right.
He said military. All right. What do you make of the fact that Tassia said, I was focused on, I can't remember what he said, his facial features and the receding hairline or the high, I think he said very high hairline. But, I mean, that's what he said he focused on in the second lineup. He didn't say anything about the military. So what do we do with that?
Well, okay, but, you know, once you see the guy in the BDU uniform, and then you think, oh, yeah, well, now I'm also supposed to look for a high forehead.
But my question's a little bit different. He said, Tassia said, I looked at the high hairline and the facial features. It may be a different case if he said, I noticed the military uniform. He doesn't mention anything about that. Don't we have to at least consider that?
Well, you have to consider that, but you also have to consider the fact that when people are shown photos, they look at the whole photo, and he's going to see that BDU pattern in a shirt, and that's going to reinforce unfairly what he's thinking he's recognizing on his forehead. I only have 2 minutes left, so I'd like to reserve the rest for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Carmen Moralida for the people. My attorney registration is 34852. And I apologize for my accent. It always comes up when I'm a little anxious.
You can raise that podium if you need to. Just the toggle switch,
yes,
on your right.
I think it's good like this, okay. Your Honors. So, Your Honors, there was no confrontation violation. In the first place, the testimony regarding the trainee's findings was brought up during the cross-examination of our expert, and that was to impeach his credibility, and that was part of the trial strategy. So I believe that any error or any violation of a confrontation right was injected by the defendant.
The testimony about the same twist did not come out.
I'm gonna go there right now, Your Honor. I believe I'm gonna address that right now. The expert testimony during cross examination did not violate. It was not a violation. Okay. Mm. Yes.
The witness testified that the test results showed the same twists and same grooves. Did the witness testify to that direct examination or cross-examination?
Direct, Your Honor.
Why isn't that elicited not or injected?
Because those were findings based on his own observations in his own work were not finding based on what the trainee did. And let me explain. So what happened here, the trainee, Ms. McMillan, yes, she did the preliminary work. She weighed the fragments and then she measured the lengths and groups. And that was before they found the pistol. So once they found the pistol, the expert he tested the pistols to check if it was functional. He also did the test fires and he did the microscopic comparison. The trainee did her own microscopic comparisons, and that's on her report, and concluded that they could not exclude the gun, but they couldn't say that was the pistol that actually fired those fragments. And her findings based on the microscopic comparisons and that's kind of like a different stage of the process. And that's actually on the record. Let me tell you why. As the expert testified, it says, this is page 156 of the transcript. We do measurements. We do that if we don't have a gun. That is the reason we do that. But actually, if we have a gun, we use test fires to compare. It's basically comparative measurements then. And then the question, that is what you did, except that the trainee did the initial measuring here until she found out we had the gun to compare to.
So I think what you're saying is the measurements ultimately became irrelevant.
Yes, Your Honor, okay. Exactly.
But then why did Mr. Brown talk about them? And if they were irrelevant, why is he talking about, as Ms. Ruttenberg pointed, she quoted his testimony. He did say that.
Yeah, because actually by doing the microscopic comparison, you can actually, I think the term he uses at that point is a comparative measurements. By using the machine, you can actually compare the measurements of the fragments found at the scene to the measurements, to the tested ones. And it's a comparative measurement, so you can actually see whether the width match or not.
But he's using the measurements that his associate did.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think he's talking about the width in terms of the comparative measurements that he did himself.
Well, let me ask you a slightly different question on this. You talk about that under Rule 703 of the Rules of Evidence that an expert can rely on hearsay, and that's one of the reasons you justify this. I guess I'm confused or not sure. Where is the line? When does reliance on hearsay testimony become a Confrontation Clause violation, if ever, in your view? Because I'm concerned that if we adopt a rule that says that, and you just rely on hearsay, isn't that an easy way around the Confrontation Clause? Can't an expert witness like Mr. Brown always just rely on 703? It's reasonable for me to rely on my associates and get around the Confrontation Clause.
I don't know. It depends on the circumstances of the case, but I think in this case, he did not rely on her findings. He did. He tested the gun. He did the microscopic comparison himself, and he came to his own conclusion that it was inconclusive. They found the same general rifling characteristics, but they couldn't find enough individual characteristics to match the gun. So at the end of the day, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's so my point is that no confrontation violation, because he did his own, he based his findings on what he did, not what she did. And at the end of the day, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because it was inconclusive. And again, as defense counsel pointed out during the cross-examination, those general rifling characteristics could match millions of guns in the U.S. So I mean, any evidentiary value of finding the general characteristic was totally undermined during the cross-examination.
Although your case in chief, as it was originally sketched out, included the testimony, the direct testimony of this assistant, and in fact you asked for a continuance so you could call that assistant. But why the necessity of calling her if the expert who testified didn't need to rely upon her information?
Sincerely, I don't know, because that's not in the record. I know that initially she was going to testify, but then she had a a training in California, and then to just call Mr. Brown. But I don't know the reason why. It's just not in the record. Do you have any other questions regarding this, Your Honors? Yes.
Does the defense attempt back to that area, can the defendant simply to mitigate
your harms beyond reasonable doubt?
I don't think I have the answer to that question, but what it renders it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt is the fact that it was inconclusive. That it was inconclusive, I think both during direct and also during cross-examination, Your Honor. Okay. So I would like to address the photographic array issue. Okay. So as I say in my brief, I think this issue is not properly before this court. I believe it was waived because it wasn't timely. They just objected at trial. This is suggestive, and defense counsel knew that at that time that Mr. Tassi at some point had made a statement that he believed the defendant was in the military. And then the trial court made overruled that objection, and defense counsel did not. And I don't believe that the court made a ruling on the suppression issue. And defense counsel did not request a ruling on that issue. So I believe it's not properly for this court.
I guess I don't understand your argument. The defense counsel objected on the exact ground Ms. Ruttenberg is raising today, and the court said overruled. What else should defense counsel have done?
The trial court said the witness has identified and authenticated the photographs, so therefore it's good. So I believe that he should have said, Your Honor, I'm talking about the fact that this array is impermissibly suggestive.
But the court ruled. I mean, there comes a point where you have to at least consider, am I going to make the judge mad? The court ruled. The court may have gotten it wrong and ruled on the wrong ground, but the court ruled on the precise objection. So I'm still not understanding your argument.
Okay, isn't it? That's what happened. I believe that the trial counsel should have at least clear up the court's ruling.
Ordinarily require the defendant to raise a motion to suppress identification or pretrial.
Don't the rules ordinarily require to raise that pretrial?
That's my understanding, yes, Your Honor.
That's your argument untimely.
Yes.
It should have been arguments and fact finding.
Before, yes. Yes, Your Honor. And in any case, on the merits, it fails. The photo arrays is a good array. All the individuals are matched by race, age, gender, facial characteristics. And it's true that the defendant has, you can see that it's wearing a shirt with a camouflage pattern, but it's not necessarily military. And also, it does not stand out. You actually, it's only appearing on close inspection. Otherwise, it's not something that really stands out of all of the photographs. So I think as a matter of law, it's not impermissibly suggestive because of that. And second, even if this court determines that it was impermissibly suggestive, the identification was reliable because Mr. Tassia had a great opportunity to see the defendant before and during the commission of the crime. They were in the basement when the defendant shoot in the ceiling, and then they were upstairs, and there was another altercation upstairs where actually the defendant pointed the gun at one of their guests, and then Mr. Tassia clearly saw the defendant getting in a vehicle, driving away, and then driving back and shooting at him, and he said, I'm 100% sure. And defense counsel said that the witnesses they provided different or contradictory a description that goes to the weight of the evidence, not its admissibility. That's for the jury to decide.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And the other thing, the defendant was also charged as a complicitor. So even assuming that he wasn't the shooter, it would have not made no difference. Because as long as the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that he was a complicitor, that's all they needed to find.
Would you respond to Ms. Ruttenberg's point that Mr. Tassi the first time picked out Mr. Morales? You say it's for his identification was reliable. I mean, he himself had two different identifications.
Actually, Your Honor, I'm not sure about that. I reviewed Mr. Tassier's transcript, and I believe that the first time he was not able to pick anyone. That's what I reviewed the transcript, and that's what I believe. He was not able to pick anyone, and that's okay, even if you don't pick anyone the first time, is the law doesn't prohibit you picking someone the second time around.
How long was there between the two?
6 months. Yeah, one was in May, the other second was November. And again, just Your Honor, here we have two other witnesses identified the defendant from a photographic array, and that's not an issue here. And this is without counting Mr. Tassia. And five witnesses identified the defendant at trial without counting Mr. Tassia. So I believe that even if it wasn't permissibly suggestive, which it was not, it was reliable under the totality of the circumstances in this case. Does anyone have any other questions? Thank you. The people request that the court affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Okay, readdressing the third issue, the lineup. I went back now and looked at Mr. Tassia's conflicting testimony. He wasn't just focused in on the forehead. He said all kinds of things. First of all, he said the first time he talked about the shooter, that he had a short, stocky build, which describes Mr. Morales, because Mr. Barco indisputably is taller and not stocky. He was very skinny. And then he described him as having long hair and having a mustache. And when he was shown a picture of Morales, his exact words looked close to the individual who had the gun. Then when he's shown the second lineup that has the picture of the guy with the BDU, that's who he identifies. Now, I'm looking at prosecution exhibit number 20. There are okay.
You're supposed to read, suppress identification testimony.
She admittedly did not do that. And if the court.
Aren't you supposed to?
Well, what I'm going to say, because I don't want to concede anything that I shouldn't, is if you rule that it was untimely, you will give me a 35C issue. I mean, I cannot change the timeliness of her objection. I am asserting that the fact that she raised that trial should be good enough to preserve it. If you find otherwise, you've given me a 35C issue.
Do you think that should
necessarily dictate the fact that you may?
No, okay. All right. Now, going back to prosecution exhibit 20, there are three individuals in there with a blue shirt on, two of which have a collar. Now, as to whether those look military or not, you know, I spent 28 years in the Air Force Reserves, and I could not tell you whether that shade of blue in 2 or 6 is that shade of Air Force blue that I used to wear. But I could. My eye draws right into that BDU pattern on individual number 5, which is what I'm contending happened to Mr. Tassia. And then he forgot all about the mustache and the long hair and the short, stocky build and said, well, that's the guy. Well, maybe that's the forehead I remember. So that's why I'm contending that lineup is impermissibly suggestive and under the totality of the circumstances rendered the identification unconstitutionally unfair to Mr. Barco. Therefore, I'm asking the court to reverse and remand for a new trial.
Can I ask you to go back to question? You know,
opposing counsel said that, maybe I misinterpreted her remarks, but she seemed to say that no, the expert that testified did his own comparative tests, and that it was his conclusion, same twist, same markings. I thought that she was arguing, and do you have a disagreement with that?
Yeah, let me give you the record site. Mr. Brown admitted that he did not conduct any independent measurements of the diameter, weight, or spacing of the lands and grooves of the bullet fragments because, quote, we already had one set of measurements, unquote, the measurements accomplished by Ms. McMillan and that's on October 1st, 2009, page 109, lines 8 through 14. And
does he, while looking at
Oh, he looked at the bullets himself.
Did he do the comparative analysis?
He did the comparative analysis himself, but he was relying on these measurements, and it's the measurements that, that are the critical piece of testimonial hearsay that we're contending. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments, counsel. This will stand submitted in due course.